Today we're going to be focused on the Joseph story. One could divide the book of Genesis up into three parts, the first part being the primeval story, the period of time from creation to Abraham. Then you have the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then the last third of the book of Genesis is actually focused on the Joseph story. Joseph was not one of the patriarchs. He was a son of the patriarch. But he is very important for the story of the nation of Israel. The story follows a similar kind of structure as the other stories in the book of Genesis, that chiastic structure that has a rising and falling action to it. Again, some of the more critical material is actually in the center of the chiasm. One way to think about it is, and this is true of a lot of stories, stories will build up to a dramatic and climactic moment, and then it will resolve at that moment, and then there will come a sort of outworking of all of the things that we're building up to in the story, all the different components. Then we see how that dramatic resolution that took place in the middle works itself out and applies to all those various points that were in conflict and tension at the opening part of the story. This is just good writing, actually. This is a way that you really can craft a story and make it a good story. And the writers of the book of Genesis, or Moses, is who I believe substantially wrote Genesis, did a very effective job writing these narratives. As we look at the story of Joseph, there is an overarching theme that arises because of a dream that Joseph has. The initial conflict of the Joseph story is in chapter 37 is caused by two things, actually. One is the human favor that Jacob shows his son. He loves Joseph more than any of his other 11 sons. And so he shows Joseph favor by an outward demonstration of a gift. And it's the coat of many colors. And he gives Joseph this beautiful robe that has all these colors. Well, this becomes a symbol of his brothers despising of their brother Joseph. They know that their dad loves him more than them. And so that robe is a sore spot. But then, to add to that, God has also given Joseph this dream, actually two dreams, that basically say the same thing, and that is that he would be the one who would lead his brothers. His brothers would bow down to him, and he would be the head guy. Now, if you're one of Joseph's brothers, you can kind of put yourself into their position a little bit, and you can sense their resentment and their anger against him. But the text tells us that they hated Joseph. They hated him. And they hated him so much that many of them were to the point of wanting to murder him. Now, of course, this is a continual theme through the book of Genesis, starting with Cain and Abel. Brothers not getting along, despising one another. And one of the sources of the despising actually comes from God's election. Him ordering things, and the other continued sore spot throughout the whole of the book of Genesis is parental favoritism violating primogeniture laws. I pulled out two key verses here where the brothers ask Joseph after he shares the content of the dream, "Are you indeed to reign over us, or indeed are you to rule over us?" So they hated him all the more for his dreams and his words. Now, just to give you a sense of how this chiasm structure works, you find that question from those brothers in chapter 37, verse 8. If you go to the end of the book of Genesis, to chapter 50, which is the corresponding chiastic element, A and A prime, you find that the brothers do in fact fulfill the content of the dream. But they have a completely different posture toward him. His brothers came and fell down before him. Behold, we are your servants. It's quite a contrast, isn't it? Do you intend to rule over us? Do you think you're going to be our king, our leader? And then at the end, yes. Behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So the whole of the Joseph story centers on this conflict between the brothers, but really what it is a conflict with the brothers and God. They don't like what God is planning and what God is doing. And so there's a struggle and a wrestling with divine providence and divine predestination. God's sovereignty is number one, revealed in the Joseph narrative in kind of a soft sovereignty by his invisible hand of guidance, ordering things, directing birth orders and parental blessings, by his leading of the characters so that they would be at the exact right place at the right time and in the exact position that they need to be to accomplish the ends for which his divine purposes have ordered things, through his protecting of key people and allowing others to be disciplined. God is clearly the one in charge, providentially guiding and ordering things all throughout the Joseph story. And this is over and against the deception, the pride, and the sin and failings of the people. Again, that verse at the end of chapter 50 is very critical for understanding the whole of book of Genesis, but also especially this particular story. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. God is in charge and in controlling things, and he will take things that you are responsible for and that you are intending for bad purposes, and he will turn them around and use them for good purposes for his glory. But there's also a hard sovereignty that comes in the form of a divine dream. In other words, God is, in a sense, not just behind the scenes laying out the plan quietly without people really knowing that he's directing and guiding things, but he actually tells people what their predetermined fate will be in the divine dreams. The predetermined outcome is revealed for 12 brothers in the form of his two dreams, and it's an outcome that will come to pass. There is nothing these brothers can do about it, Joseph or the other ones. It will come to pass. God will bring about this dream. And their despising of Joseph is actually a despising of the predestination and will of the Lord in this moment. And I can tell you that this is not an uncommon issue for people down through the history of redemptive history. Anytime God has revealed his predetermined will and said, this is the way it's going to be, people have always bucked that and never liked that idea that God is setting the course of things and he's the one in charge. But they especially don't like the messenger who delivers that message. Which of the prophets did you not stone? Stephen asks as he's being stoned. Anytime a prophet comes, one of the reasons why they're despised and they're not liked is because they're telling people what the future is going to hold for them. And they're telling them that if you do this and you don't do this, this is what's coming down the pipe. They don't like the predestining will of God. So they can't throw a rock at God. So what do? They throw it at the prophet. And this is exactly what happens to Joseph. He's being a mouthpiece for the Lord. The brothers don't like what they heard. They don't like the prophecy. But they can't attack the Lord. So they attack the one who delivers the prophecy. Here comes the dreamer, they say. Now it's interesting that Jacob, who has had a little bit of experience with divine revelation, questions the prophecy, but ponders it. He doesn't have quite the reaction that the brothers in their immaturity have. The story tells us that he kept the saying in mind. One of the articles in the 39 Articles of Religion is actually about the theology of predestination. And there's an interesting line in it. It says this: for carnal persons to have continually before their eyes the sentence of God's predestination is a most dangerous downfall. Whenever people who are worldly or not wanting to submit to God or to his authority have presented before them, this is the way God is going to plan things and this is the outcome, it actually can send them into desperation, rebellion, anger. This has always been the case with the doctrine of predestination. What's theologically noteworthy, this is Gerhard von Rad, who was a German theologian, who actually wrote during the time of World War I and World War II and was very concerned that people were dismissing the Old Testament. So he focused all of his studies on the Old Testament and wrote a lot of commentaries. What Gerhard von Rad wrote in his commentary on Genesis is, what is theologically noteworthy is the way in which the strong predestination content of the speech is combined with a strong summons to action. The fact that God has determined the matter, that God hastens to bring it to pass, is precisely the reason for responsible leaders to take measures. And so here is one of the paradoxes and mysteries of Christian theology and actually biblical theology. This is in the Old Covenant. Yes, God predetermines, and there is this sovereign will of God that is throughout the pages of Scripture. He has a purpose and a plan, and he will accomplish his plan through both the hard sovereignty of announcing his predetermined will through prophetic revelation and through the soft providence of his invisible hand guiding things. God is in control and in charge of all things. But the other side of the paradox is God holds us responsible for our choices and our decisions. And our choices really do matter. Outcomes are contingent upon faithful or unfaithful decision making and choices on our part. When we rebel against God, there's consequences for that rebellion. When we're faithful to God, we can often find ourselves receiving the blessings and benefits of that. And so this is one of the mysteries of the Holy Scriptures, is how there can be both divine sovereignty and human responsibility and human accountability. And yet, nevertheless, we find both of these things present here in the book of Genesis. Joseph interprets two more pairs of dreams when he's in Egypt. And we see, instead of rebellion against the sovereign will of God, we find submission to it on the part of Pharaoh and the Egyptian hearers. The dreams again reveal the predestination of God and his plan. The brothers rebelled against the plan of God, but in contrast, the Egyptian hearers recognize and trust the sovereignty of God revealed in the dream and honor the messenger. Rather than attacking the messenger, they raise him up as being one whom they recognize as speaking of the Spirit of God. Can we find a man like this in whom the Spirit of God? The Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all of this, there is none discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house. They furthermore spring into action and take complete responsibility for the plan that has been revealed to them and begin to make their own plans on how they're going to deal with what has been revealed, which was that there would be a great famine in the land of Egypt. And they use the occasion of the revelation of the predetermined plan of God to find themselves under that plan in a blessed position. So they save up and stockpile. And so when the outcome happens, the famine occurs, they're ready for it. Why? They listened. Listen to what God said he was going to do. And they trusted in his will. Yes.
That point always confused me, because the Egyptians are technically Gentiles. They're not of the Jewish faith, but yet they believed that it was from God. So when did they deviate from that? When did they start worshiping other gods?
Well, that's a great question. One, the question has to do with, aren't these Gentiles? And again, this is a constant theme throughout the pages of the Scriptures. We like to think that only the New Testament is really reaching out to Gentiles, but all of the Scriptures often use Gentile belief to contrast with the Israelite unbelief. We're going to get to that in the Gospel of Matthew. We have a Canaanite who believes when all of the disciples don't believe. But guess what? That is actually an echo of this story, where a Gentile, a Canaanite, Tamar, is considered more righteous by the Judah, who will be the one through whom the kings of Israel will come. She's the Canaanite. She believes and is more righteous. He doesn't. And this is the sad story of the nation of Israel. Here they receive the particular revelation of God, and they have a very special and honorific place and have been called to this mediatorial role for the nations of the world. Remember the promise given to Abraham, through you all the nations of the world will be blessed? That's their job. And yet, sometimes God fulfills that purpose in their lives in spite of their hard-heartedness and rebellion against Him, and uses Israel to bless the nations of the world. There is a certain sense that the nations recognize the sovereignty of God when they see it. And again, not to spring ahead too much, but I will just give you one application about this. The announcement of the gospel that Jesus Christ is Lord, that is a proclamation of the sovereignty of God and the sovereignty of Jesus. That's the message that wins hearts and minds in the Gentile world. Proclaim and lift up Jesus as Lord, and the nations bend the knee to Him. Every place the gospel has been preached faithfully, people have given their lives to the Lord and Savior of the world. It doesn't matter where you go in this world, you can proclaim that message, Jesus Christ is Lord, and the knees bow and the tongues confess. It's amazing. One of the things that we find throughout the book of Genesis, or through this Joseph story, it actually is in the whole of the book of Genesis, but it really comes to a dramatic moment here in the book of Joseph's story, is this idea of the cloak. Throughout the Joseph story runs a cloak theme. Joseph bears three different garments which are used to convey and bestow honor and shame upon him. Now, I said the cloak idea comes very early on in the book of Genesis, when Adam and Eve are confronted by God after eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Who told you that you were naked? Because before that, they didn't need clothing. They didn't need anything to cover there, because they were naked and unashamed, as the Bible says. I know a lot of young children like to live naked and unashamed. But as we get older and we start to realize how awkward and we start to realize our nakedness. We start to see that we are people of shame, and we want to cover ourselves up. But think about this. One of the things that we do with our coverings is we often will create a false facade. We use beautiful clothes to convey that I'm beautiful, when maybe what's going on inside or with our actions is not so beautiful. And so garments convey things about, number one, what we think about ourselves, but they also are trying to gain an opinion from other people. Now, of course, God sees right through our clothes, and Adam and Eve can't hide from the Lord, who told you that you were naked. And the Lord is the one that provides garments for Adam and Eve. He clothes them with animal skins, even though they had been covered up with fig leaves. Remember that? So here's the way that the cloak and deception... I wanted to put cloak and dagger, but I couldn't find a dagger in there. But the cloak and deception that runs through this story. First of all, Joseph is given the first cloak, which is the robe of many colors. This cloak symbolizes both his high status and love from his father. And it also becomes the object of scorn and jealousy for his brothers. As the story unfolds, he is stripped of his dignity, and the cloak is used as a means of deception to assassinate Joseph in his father's heart and mind. They take the very symbol of Joseph's honor to his father, and they smear it with blood from a goat and give it to his father, and his father is devastated because his son has died. Now, he hasn't technically died, but they lie about everything that happened. And so the cloak is actually a cover-up and a deception. That which is honorific becomes shameful and displays the corruption of humanity. Again, the same thing happens with a second cloak. Joseph is sold into slavery, and he finds himself in an Egyptian captain of a guard, Potiphar, in his home serving as a servant. And one day Joseph is by himself with Potiphar's wife, and Potiphar notices, hey, Joseph's an attractive looking guy. And she starts to make a sensual pass at him. And Joseph, as a person of integrity and one who is wanting to be faithful to his master and to the Lord, resists her impositions. And she grabs his cloak and tries to grab him. And instead of being grabbed, he is willing to undergo a shame of sorts. And he leaves his cloak. He allows himself to move back to that place of nakedness and shame to get away from her. Isn't that interesting? So the cloak, again, is a symbol of his integrity. And he's willing to become humiliated and lose his integrity from an outward standpoint in order to save his integrity from an inward standpoint. Okay, you can have that. But then what happens again? That cloak gets used deceptively to completely destroy his reputation. You know, here he was, a very faithful and loved servant of Potiphar's house, and yet the wife of Potiphar uses his cloak as evidence against him. See, he came, he grabbed me, I tried to get away, he grabbed his cloak, and as he was fleeing, because I screamed, and I got the cloak, and here's the evidence that he tried to attack me. So his reputation is all wrapped up in the cloak, but what we know about Joseph is he is completely a person of integrity. That the cloak symbolizes that, but it really doesn't. There's something deeper inside of him in his personhood. Now then, the last cloak, Joseph, as the story progresses, is put into prison. He has a couple of dreams for the people in the prison. There's a cupbearer and a baker, I think, for Pharaoh's cupbearer and baker are in there with him, and they have dreams. And the dream basically says, well, you're going to live and you're going to die. And it's, again, the predestinating will of God. It comes to pass. Pharaoh's completely impressed by what he hears about this guy's ability to interpret dreams. And Pharaoh is given a couple of dreams and brings Joseph out of prison to say, hey, you know, I'm not having a lot of luck understanding what these revelations that I'm getting are. I hear you're pretty good with some dreams. Can you tell me what these are about? My guys aren't really getting it. And so Pharaoh listens to Joseph and submits to what Joseph says. And the final cloak of the story is the cloak that is granted to Joseph by Pharaoh. After he, quote, wisely interprets Pharaoh's dream, this robe symbolized the status to which God had elevated and blessed Joseph from his humility as a discarded brother, a slave, and a prisoner. And while humanity, men and women alike, may by force and deception strip a person of his reputation and his status, ultimately it is the Lord who bestows greatness on a person and authority. And that's pretty applicable to life. You can take that one to the bank. And it's very comforting. What it means is it doesn't matter what other people think about you or what other people do to you. They can't take away your dignity. That's only for you to give away. Your integrity belongs to you and God. And Joseph as a person is a man of integrity before the Lord. And even though people strip him of reputation, status, honor, they can't ever take away that. He is protected by the Lord. And the Lord will ultimately honor him. Again, it goes back to that initial story between the Tower of Babel and Abraham. People always want to make a name great for themselves. But it's God who gives us a great name. And that's the promise to Abraham. I will make your name great, and I will make you a great nation. We can't make it happen on our own. And that's a lot of times what we're trying to do with our outward presentation that we put towards people. We're trying to make ourselves great, trying to make our name great. But God will do that for us. We don't have to. Now, there's a secondary plot that is running through here. Joseph seems to be the main character in this story, but there's actually a secondary main character. And that's the character of Judah. Judah also has a symbol of his status and disgrace. For Joseph, it was the cloak. For Judah, it's actually his ring and his scepter. These are used to symbolize Judah's royal status and his personal disgrace. Judah ultimately is going to be the one through whom the king of Israel will come. That's the prophecy in chapter 49, 8 through 12. However, he has to learn what it means to be humble and to be a part of the family of God and committed to his brothers. He, in the story of Judah and Tamar, leaves his family and goes to live with Canaanites. He abandons the family. And he has a certain lack of self-control when it comes to his, shall we say, scepter. That's the joke in Genesis. And it's there. There's humor throughout the book of Genesis, actually. And in many ways, you kind of have to get the little plays on words. But another example is Isaac, Iyuk. I mean, his name is an onomatopoeia, like when Sarah laughs that I'm 90 years old and you're going to give me a child. So she names the kid, he laughs. What a joke. Isaac's a joke. So the ultimate prophecy is the scepter shall not depart from Judah. And in that prophecy is actually the image of the staff. Okay, so again, what was a means of shame and disgrace where Judah gives up his staff in order to give a pledge of surety to a prostitute as payment? And then when it's revealed that the, quote, prostitute was actually his daughter-in-law, whom he was withholding her primogeniture rights from, he actually becomes the one shamed when those items are revealed. And she says, look, it's you who was the one who did this. Oh my, you're more righteous than I, he says of Tamar. So Judah learns humility and he gets a very big lesson in self-control. Of course, the kings of Israel continue to have a problem with self-control. We'll learn about this again when we get to the story of David, child of Judah. But his staff and glory and his downfall, Judah's own sin led him to bestow the signet ring and staff of his rule as surety for his pledge of a goat. But the ultimate way that that story ends, as you go to the corresponding components and the chiastic elements, is that ultimately, the staff becomes the scepter that will pass down from generation to generation until it gets to the one to whom it belongs. And the obedience of the nations will be his. Now, Tamar is mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus Christ in the book of Matthew. She is the matriarch of not only Perez and what will become the King David, but she is the matriarch of the Messiah. It's the point that Matthew brings. A Canaanite woman. You also have here the issue of Egypt, famine, and slavery. The center element of the Joseph narrative is the place of character development and reversals. Joseph is given absolute power over his brothers' lives, and yet his heart is moved to compassion, love, and service of them. There's the big turning point in the book of the Joseph story is when his heart is softened towards his brothers, and he's moved beyond emotion. He weeps with compassion towards his brothers. But there's a particular thing that sort of breaks the dam and softens the heart of Joseph. It's when... What?
Is that the gold cup that he puts in Benjamin's sack and then they...
Yeah, he puts the gold cup in Benjamin's sack, right? And Judah pledges himself as surety for his brother Benjamin. That's the moment, okay? Now think about this. And the interesting ironies of the book of Genesis. Joseph pledges his honor and his dignity in the form of a signet ring and a staff for surety for a goat. You know, Judy's willing to give up these symbols of his rule and reign for a prostitute and a goat. But then where he grows and matures as a person is, now I'm willing to give up my personhood for my brother, Benjamin. Because I know what it'll mean to my father. And this is a huge development for the character of Judah. He is the one that left his family, as I mentioned before. So that's the moment, and we see in that the development of Judah as the king who lays down his life for his people. Interesting. And we also see the moment where reconciliation happens between the 12 tribes of Israel. And what was a warring and divided family now becomes a united family that is reconciled to one another because of the one who laid down his life for his family. Very powerful images that will come to ultimate fruition in the person of Jesus Christ. We also have the issue of bondage. The brothers become servants to Joseph and slaves in Egypt. Ultimately, Egypt will become part of a cruel bondage as everybody sells themselves into slavery for daily bread because they have not believed the revelations of God. There are two kingdoms. We alluded to this earlier with Therese's question, but the promise of a great nation that will ultimately bless all the nations of the world, Genesis 12, occurs within the wider context of the universal kingdom of God's world. All the nations of the world are under the ultimate authority of Yahweh. And God speaks to the kings of the world. He speaks to Pharaoh in dreams. The problem that Pharaoh has is that he needs the mediating role of Israel to help him understand what God's trying to say to him. And again, this is what Israel's job is in the world. Israel's job is to mediate God's covenant to the people of the world. So it was completely appropriate for Pharaoh to come to Israel and ask Israel for the meaning and significance of God's revealed word. What does it mean? Israel is playing its special role. And there's this interaction that you see between the kingdom of the world and the special and unique kingdom of the people of God. Without Egypt, Israel would have starved from a famine of food. Without Israel, Egypt would have starved from a famine of God's revealed word. So Joseph, like Daniel and others who will come later in the story of redemptive history, us, must learn how to be in the world but not of it, to integrate with and serve the universal kingdom without compromise to it. God can and will continue to preserve and bless the faithful remnant of his people, even in the midst of the exile. Let me turn to the story of the gospel. And again, we're going to go much deeper in the New Testament study. But this next section of the gospel has to do with faltering faith and true greatness. Remember, there's the narrative discourses in the way the gospel of Matthew is structured. And I'm just going to have time today to focus on the narrative portion, the resisting faith in Jesus, chapters 13 through 17, which you'll be reading through this week. There are 13 stories within this narrative portion. And the overarching theme of the narrative portion is the issue of faith. That's a unifying theme of all 13 episodes, faith in Jesus as the Messiah. The focus, though, is primarily on the faith of the disciples, but it's also wrestling with the faith of others. It starts off with Jesus being rejected in his hometown of Nazareth. Jesus did not do many mighty works there because they lacked faith. The second story, Herod does not dispute Jesus' fame in doing mighty works, but rather is under judgment for murdering God's prophet John the Baptist. The next three episodes, though, focus on the disciples and their need to grow in their faith. You have the story of the feeding of the 5,000, where Jesus challenges the faith of the disciples. You give them something to eat, and they go, well, where are we going to do that? How are we going to make that happen? We've only got these 5 loaves and 2 fishes. But Jesus demonstrates to them that their little small actor offering is something which God will multiply greatly. Jesus will then send them out on a lake in a boat and come to them walking on the water. Peter is excited and demonstrates a measure of faith, but immediately looks at the wind and begins to sink. And Peter is challenged, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Jesus then gets into a conflict with Pharisees over internal and external righteousness. It's not what comes into a person that makes a person unclean, but what comes out of a person. And when Peter asks for a simple clarification about Jesus' teaching and the meaning of his parables, he's questioned by Jesus, "Are you still without understanding?" And so it continues. The Canaanite woman is used as a contrast. Like Tamar in the story of Judah and Tamar, she is commended for being more righteous than the Israelite. And she is commended for having great faith, while the disciples continue to show a marked lack of it. And they have another feeding of the 4,000 and the same types of doubts. And in 6:8, Jesus says of his disciples, they have little faith. Peter then expresses tremendous faith in his confession. "Jesus, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God." But then is immediately rebuked as Satan, not having in mind the things of God, but of men, for his denial of the cross and lack of trust of who the Messiah came to be and what the Messiah came to do. He sees the glory of Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration and yet mistakenly wants to set up a shrine to Jesus on the mountain rather than allow Jesus to fulfill his God-intended mission. And in 17:14-13, Jesus explains the reason why the disciples could not exorcise the young demoniac. "You have too little faith." So the stories of, in that section all have to do with the little bit of faith and the lack of faith on the part of being a disciple of Jesus. And the application of that, as we're working our way through that, is we have to examine our own faith. We need to ask, do we really trust Jesus for who he is and what he is offering to us and what he wants to do in our lives? We lack the faith to see both his power manifest in his life. We trust him too little and we expect too little from him. But we also lack the kind of faith to really trust him with being faithful to him and to doing the things that God wants to do in and through us by being a person of integrity and walking in his ways. It takes great faith to do both of those things. One, to trust God for his mighty acts, but also to trust God with his plan for our lives and be faithful to it. Oh, you of little faith. Why don't we stop there?